Fatigue gave an unreal, nightmarish cast to the whole scene. It couldn't be real. Or if it was real, then the world had gone mad. If not, why should she be standing here in Aunt Pity's peaceful front yard, amid wavering lights, pouring water over dying beaux? For so many of them were her beaux, and they tried to smile when they saw her. There were so many men jolting down this dark, dusty road whom she knew so well, so many men dying here before her eyes, mosquitoes and gnats swarming their bloody faces, men with whom she had danced and laughed, for whom she had played music and sung songs, teased, comforted, and loved. A little. She found Carrie Ashburn on the bottom layer of wounded in an ox cart, barely alive from a bullet wound in his head. But she could not extricate him without disturbing six other wounded men. So she let him go on to the hospital. Later she heard he had died before a doctor ever saw him and was buried somewhere. No one knew exactly. So many men had been buried that month, in shallow, hastily dug graves at Oakland Cemetery. Melanie felt it keenly that they had not been able to get a lock of Carrie's hair to send to his mother in Alabama. As the hot night wore on and their backs were aching and their knees buckling from weariness, Scarlet and Pity cried to man after man, "What news? What news?" And as the long hours dragged past, they had their answer, an answer that made them look whitely into each other's eyes. "We're falling back. We've got to fall back. They outnumber us by thousands. The Yankees have got Wheeler's cavalry cut off near Decatur. We've got to reinforce them. Our boys will all be in town soon." Scarlet and Pity clutched each other's arms for support. Are the Yankees coming?
"Yes'm. They're coming all right. But they ain't going to get far, lady."
"Don't fret, miss. They can't take Atlanta."
"No, ma'am. We got a million miles of breastworks round this town. I heard old Joe say it myself. I can hold Atlanta forever."
"But we ain't got old Joe. We got—"
"Shut up, you fool. Do you want to scare the ladies?" "The Yankees will never take this place, ma'am. Why don't you ladies go to Macon and somewheres that's safer? Ain't you got no kinfolks there?" "The Yankees ain't going to take Atlanta, but still, it ain't going to be so healthy for ladies whilst they're trying it. There's going to be a powerful lot of shelling."
In a warm, steaming rain the next day, the defeated army poured through Atlanta by thousands, exhausted by hunger and weariness, depleted by 76 days of battle and retreat, their horses starved scarecrows, their cannon and caissons harnessed with odds and ends of rope and strips of rawhide. But they did not come in as a disorderly rabble in full rout. They marched in good order, jaunty for all their rags, their torn red battle flags flying in the rain. They had learned retreating under old Joe, who had made it as great a feat of strategy as advancing. The bearded, shabby files swung down Peachtree Street to the tune of "Maryland, my Maryland," and all the town turned out to cheer them. In victory or defeat, they were their boys. The state militia, who had gone out so short a time before, resplendent in new uniforms, could hardly be distinguished from the seasoned troops, so dirty and unkempt were they. There was a new look in their eyes. 3 years of apologizing, of explaining why they were not at the front, was behind them now. They had traded security behind the lines for the hardships of battle. Many of their number had traded easy living for hard death. They were veterans now. Veterans of brief service, but veterans just the same. And they had acquitted themselves well. They searched out the faces of friends in the crowd and stared at them proudly, defiantly. They could hold up their heads now. The old men and the boys of the home guard marched by, the gray beards almost too weary to lift their feet, the boys wearing the faces of tired children, confronted too early with adult problems. Scarlet caught sight of Phil Meade and hardly recognized him, so black was his face with powder and grime, so taut with strain and weariness. Uncle Henry went limping by, hatless in the rain, his head stuck through a hole in a piece of old oilcloth. Grandpa Merriweather rode in on a gun carriage, his bare feet tied in quilt scraps. But search though she might, she saw no sign of John Wilkes. Johnston's veterans, however, went by with the tireless, careless step which had carried them for 3 years, and they still had the energy to grin and wave at pretty girls, and to call rude jibes to men not in uniform. They were on their way to the entrenchments that ringed the town. No shallow, hastily dug trenches these, but earthworks, breast high, reinforced with sandbags and tipped with sharpened staves of wood. For mile after mile the trenches encircled the town, red gashes surmounted by red mounds, waiting for the men who would fill them. The crowd cheered the troops as they would have cheered them in victory. There was fear in every heart, but now that they knew the truth, now that the worst had happened, now that the war was in their front yard, a change came over the town. There was no panic now, no hysteria. Whatever lay in hearts did not show on faces. Everyone looked cheerful, even if the cheer was strained. Everyone tried to show brave, confident faces to the troops. Everyone repeated what old Joe had said just before he was relieved of command. I can hold Atlanta forever. Now that Hood had had to retreat, quite a number wished, with the soldiers, that they had old Joe back, but they forbore saying it, and took courage from old Joe's remark. I can hold Atlanta forever. Not for Hood the cautious tactics of General Johnston. He assaulted the Yankees on the east. He assaulted them on the west. Sherman was circling the town like a wrestler seeking a fresh hold on an opponent's body, and Hood did not remain behind his rifle pits waiting for the Yankees to attack. He went out boldly to meet them and savagely fell upon them. Within the space of a few days, the battles of Atlanta and of Ezra Church were fought, and both of them were major engagements which made Peachtree Creek seem like a skirmish. But the Yankees kept coming back for more. They had suffered heavy losses, but they could afford to lose. And all the while their batteries poured shells into Atlanta, killing people in their homes, ripping roofs off buildings, tearing huge craters in the streets. The townsfolk sheltered as best they could in cellars, in holes in the ground and in shallow tunnels dug in railroad cuts. Atlanta was under siege. Within 11 days, after he had taken command, General Hood had lost almost as many men as Johnston had lost in 74 days of battle and retreat, and Atlanta was hemmed in on 3 sides. The railroad from Atlanta to Tennessee was now in Sherman's hands for its full length. His army was across the railroad to the east, and he had cut the railroad running southwest to Alabama. Only the one railroad to the south, to Macon and Savannah, was still open. The town was crowded with soldiers, swamped with wounded, jammed with refugees, and this one line was inadequate for the crying needs of the stricken city. But as long as this railroad could be held, Atlanta could still stand. Scarlett was terrified when she realized how important this line had become, how fiercely Sherman would fight to take it, how desperately Hood would fight to defend it. For this was the railroad which ran through the county, through Jonesboro. And Terra was only 5 miles from Jonesboro. Terra seemed like a haven of refuge by comparison with the screaming hell of Atlanta. But Terra was only 5 miles from Jonesboro. Scarlet and many other ladies sat on the flat roofs of stores, shaded by their tiny parasols, and watched the fighting on the day of the Battle of Atlanta. But when shells began falling in the streets, for the first time, they fled to the cellars. And that night, the exodus of women, children, and old people from the city began. Macon was their destination. And many of those who took the train that night had already refugeed 5 and 6 times before, as Johnston fell back from Dalton. They were traveling lighter now than when they arrived in Atlanta. Most of them carried only a carpet bag and a scanty lunch done up in a bandana handkerchief. Here and there, frightened servants carried silver pitchers, knives and forks, and a family portrait or two which had been salvaged in the first flight. Mrs. Merriweather and Mrs. Elsing refused to leave. They were needed at the hospital, and furthermore, they said proudly, they weren't afraid, and no Yankees were going to run them out of their homes. But Maybelle and her baby, and Fanny Elsing went to Macon. Mrs. Meade was disobedient for the first time in her married life, and flatly refused to yield to the doctor's command that she take the train to safety. The doctor needed her, she said. Moreover, Phil was somewhere in the trenches, and she wanted to be nearby in case... But Mrs. Whiting went, and many other ladies of Scarlet Circle. Aunt Pitty, who had been the first to denounce old Joe for his policy of retreat, was among the first to pack her trunks. Her nerves, she said, were delicate, and she could not endure noises. She feared she might faint at an explosion and not be able to reach the cellar. No, she was not afraid. Her baby mouth tried to set in martial lines, but failed. She'd go to Macon and stay with her cousin, old Mrs. Burr, and the girl should come with her. Scarlett did not want to go to Macon. Frightened as she was of the shells, she'd rather stay in Atlanta than go to Macon, for she hated old Mrs. Burr cordially. Years ago, Mrs. Burr had said she was fast, after catching her kissing her son Willie at one of the Wilkes's house parties. No, she told Aunt Pitty, I'll go home to Tara, and Melly can go to Macon with you. At this, Melanie began to cry in a frightened, heartbroken way. When Aunt Pitty fled to get Dr. Meade, Melanie caught Scarlett's hand in hers, pleading, "Dear, don't go to Tara and leave me. I'll be so lonely without you. Oh, Scarlett, I'd just die if you weren't with me when the baby came. Yes. Yes, I know I've got Aunt Pitty, and she is sweet. But after all, she's never had a baby, and sometimes she makes me so nervous I could scream. Don't desert me, darling. You've been just like a sister to me, and besides..." She smiled wanly. "You promised Ashley you'd take care of me. He told me he was going to ask you." Scarlett stared down at her in wonderment. With her own dislike of this woman so strong she could barely conceal it, how could Melly love her so? How could Melly be so stupid as to not guess the secret of her love of Ashley? She had given herself away 100 times during these months of torment, waiting for news of him. But Melanie saw nothing. Melanie, who could see nothing but good in anyone she loved. Yes, she had promised Ashley she would look out for Melanie. "Oh, Ashley, Ashley, you must be dead. Dead these many months. And now your promise reaches out and clutches me." "Well," she said shortly, "I did promise him that. And I don't go back on my promises. But I won't go to Macon and stay with that old Burr cat. I'd claw her eyes out in 5 minutes. I'm going home to Tara, and you can come with me. Mother would love to have you." "Oh, I'd like that. Your mother is so sweet. But you know Auntie would just die if she wasn't with me when the baby came. And I know she won't go to Tara. It's too close to the fighting, and Auntie wants to be safe." Dr. Meade, who had arrived out of breath, expecting to find Melanie in premature labor at least, judging by Aunt Pitty's alarmed summoning, was indignant and said as much. And upon learning the cause of the upset, he settled the matter with words that left no room for argument. "It's out of the question for you to go to Macon, Miss Melly. I won't answer for you if you move. The trains are crowded and uncertain, and the passengers are liable to be put off in the woods at any time, if the trains are needed for wounded or troops and supplies. In your condition...
But if I went to Tara with Scarlet,
I tell you I won't have you moved. The train to Tara is the train to Macon, and the same conditions prevail. Moreover, no one knows just where the Yankees are now. But they are all over everywhere. Your train might even be captured. And even if you reached Jonesboro safely, there'd be a 5-mile ride over the rough road before you ever reached Tara. It's no trip for a woman in a delicate condition. Besides, there's not a doctor in the county since old Dr. Fontaine joined the army.
But there are midwives. I said, a doctor.
He answered brusquely, and his eyes unconsciously went over her tiny frame. I won't have you moved. It might be dangerous. You don't want to have the baby on the train or in a buggy, do you?
This medical frankness reduced the ladies to embarrassed blushes and silence.
You've got to stay right here where I can watch you. And you must stay in bed. No running up and down stairs to cellars. No, not even if shells come right in the window. After all, there's not so much danger here. We'll have the Yankees beaten back in no time. Now, Miss Pitty, you go right on to Macon and leave the young ladies here.
Unchaperoned? She cried, aghast.
They are matrons, said the doctor testily. And Mrs. Meade is just 2 houses away. They won't be receiving any mail company anyway with Miss Melly in her condition. Good heavens, Miss Pitty. This is wartime. We can't think of the proprieties now. We must think of Miss Melly.
He stamped out of the room and waited on the front porch until Scarlet joined him.
I shall talk frankly to you, Miss Scarlet, he began, jerking at his gray beard. You seem to be a young woman of common sense, so spare me your blushes. I do not want to hear any further talk about Miss Melly being moved. I doubt if she could stand the trip. She's going to have a difficult time, even in the best of circumstances. Very narrow in the hips, as you know. And probably will need forceps for her delivery, so I don't want any ignorant darky midwife meddling with her. Women like her should never have children, but... Anyway. You pack Miss Pitty's trunk and send her to Macon. She's so scared she'll upset Miss Melly, and that won't do any good. And now, miss... He fixed her with a piercing glance. I don't want to hear about you going home, either. You stay with Miss Melly till the baby comes. Not afraid, are you?
Oh, no,
lied Scarlet, stoutly. That's a brave girl. Mrs. Meade will give you whatever chaperonage you need, and I'll send over old Betsy to cook for you, if Miss Pitty wants to take her servants with her. It won't be for long. The baby ought to be here in another 5 weeks. But you can never tell with first babies, and all this shelling going on. It may come any day.
So Aunt Pitty Pat went to Macon, in floods of tears, taking Uncle Peter and Cookie with her. The carriage and horse she donated to the hospital in a burst of patriotism, which she immediately regretted, and that brought on more tears. And Scarlet and Melanie were left alone, with Wade and Prissy, in a house that was much quieter, even though the cannonading continued. Chapter 19. In those first days of the siege, when the Yankees crashed here and there against the defenses of the city, Scarlet was so frightened by the bursting shells, she could only cower helplessly, her hands over her ears, expecting every moment to be blown into eternity. When she heard the whistling screams that heralded their approach, she rushed to Melanie's room and flung herself on the bed beside her, and the two clutched each other, screaming, "Oh! Oh!" as they buried their heads in the pillows. Prissy and Wade scurried for the cellar, and crouched in the cobwebbed darkness,
Prissy squalling at the top of her voice, and Wade sobbing and hiccuping. Suffocating under feather pillows while death screamed overhead, Scarlet silently cursed Melanie for keeping her from the safer regions below stairs. But the doctor had forbidden Melanie to walk, and Scarlet had to stay with her. Added to her terror of being blown to pieces was her equally active terror that Melanie's baby might arrive at any moment. Sweat broke out on Scarlet with clammy dampness whenever this thought entered her mind. What would she do if the baby started coming? She knew she'd rather let Melanie die than go out on the streets to hunt for the doctor when the shells were falling like April rain. And she knew Prissy could be beaten to death before she would venture forth. What would she do if the baby came? These matters she discussed with Prissy in whispers one evening, as they prepared Melanie's supper tray, and Prissy, surprisingly enough, calmed her fears.
"Miss Scarlet, ef we can't get the doctor when Miss Melly's time come, don't you bother. I can manage. I knows all about birthin'. Ain't my ma a midwife? Ain't she raised me to be a midwife, too? Just you leave it to me."
Scarlet breathed more easily, knowing that experienced hands were near, but she nevertheless yearned to have the ordeal over and done with. Mad to be away from exploding shells, desperate to get home to the quiet of Terra, she prayed every night that the baby would arrive the next day, so she would be released from her promise and could leave Atlanta. Terra seemed so safe, so far away from all this misery. Scarlet longed for home and her mother as she had never longed for anything in all her life. If she were just near Ellen, she wouldn't be afraid, no matter what happened. Every night after a day of screeching, ear-splitting shells, she went to bed determined to tell Melanie the next morning that she could not stand Atlanta another day, that she would have to go home, and Melanie would have to go to Mrs. Meade's. But as she lay on her pillow, there always rose the memory of Ashley's face, as it had looked when she last saw him, drawn as with an inner pain, with a little smile on his lips. "You'll take care of Melanie, won't you? You're so strong. Promise me." And she had promised. Somewhere, Ashley lay dead. Wherever he was watching her, holding her to that promise. Living or dead, she could not fail him, no matter what the cost. So she remained, day after day. In response to Ellen's letters, pleading with her to come home, she wrote minimizing the dangers of the siege, explaining Melanie's predicament and promising to come as soon as the baby was born. Ellen, sensitive to the bonds of kin, be they blood or marriage, wrote back reluctantly agreeing that she must stay, but demanding that Wade and Prissy be sent home immediately. This suggestion met with the complete approval of Prissy, who was now reduced to teeth-chattering idiocy at every unexpected sound. She spent so much time crouching in the cellar that the girls would have fared badly but for Mrs. Meade's stolid old Betsy. Scarlet was as anxious as her mother to have Wade out of Atlanta, not only for the child's safety, but because his constant fear irritated her. Wade was terrified to speechlessness by the shelling, and even when lulls came, he clung to Scarlet's skirts, too terrified to cry. He was afraid to go to bed at night, afraid of the dark, afraid to sleep, lest the Yankees should come and get him. And the sound of his soft, nervous whimpering in the night grated unendurably on her nerves. Secretly, she was just as frightened as he was, but it angered her to be reminded of it every minute by his tense, drawn face. Yes, Tara was the place for Wade. Prissy should take him there and return immediately to be present when the baby came. But before Scarlet could start the two on their homeward journey, news came that the Yankees had swung to the south and were skirmishing along the railroad between Atlanta and Jonesboro. Suppose the Yankees should capture the train on which Wade and Prissy were riding? Scarlet and Melanie turned pale at the thought, for everyone knew that Yankee atrocities on helpless children were even more dreadful than on women. So she feared to send him home, and he remained in Atlanta, a frightened, silent little ghost, pattering about desperately after his mother, fearing to have her skirt out of his hand for even a minute. The siege went on through the hot days of July, thundering days following nights of sullen, ominous stillness, and the town began to adjust itself. It was as though, the worst having happened, they had nothing more to fear. They had feared a siege, and now they had a siege, and after all, it wasn't so bad. Life could and did go on almost as usual. They knew they were sitting on a volcano, but until that volcano erupted, there was nothing they could do. So why worry now?
And probably it wouldn't erupt anyway. Just look how General Hood is holding the Yankees out of the city. And see how the cavalry is holding the railroad to Macon. Sherman will never take it. But for all their apparent insouciance in the face of falling shells and shorter rations, for all their ignoring the Yankees barely half a mile away, and for all their boundless confidence in the ragged line of gray men in the rifle pits, there pulsed, just below the skin of Atlanta, a wild uncertainty over what the next day would bring. Suspense, worry, sorrow, hunger, and the torment of rising, falling, rising hope was wearing that skin thin. Gradually, Scarlet drew courage from the brave faces of her friends, and from the merciful adjustment which nature makes when what cannot be cured must be endured. To be sure, she still jumped at the sound of explosions, but now she didn't run screaming to burrow her head under Melanie's pillow. She could now gulp and say weakly, "That one was close, wasn't it?" She was less frightened also because life had taken on the quality of a dream too terrible to be real. It wasn't possible that she, Scarlet O'Hara, should be in such a predicament, with the danger of death about her every hour, every minute. It wasn't possible that the quiet tenor of life could have changed so completely in so short a time. It was unreal, grotesquely unreal. That morning skies which dawned so tenderly blue could be so profaned with cannon smoke that hung over the town like low thunderclouds, that warm noontides filled with the piercing sweetness of massed honeysuckle and climbing roses could be so fearful. As shells screamed into the streets, bursting like the crack of doom, throwing iron splinters hundreds of yards, blowing people and animals to bits. Quiet, drowsy afternoon siestas had ceased to be, for though the clamor of battle might lull from time to time, Peachtree Street was alive and noisy at all hours, cannon and ambulances rumbling by, wounded stumbling in from the rifle pits, regiments hurrying past at double-quick, ordered from the ditches on one side of town to the defense of some hard-pressed earthworks on the other, and couriers dashing headlong down the street toward headquarters as though the fate of the Confederacy hung on them. The hot nights brought a measure of quiet, but it was a sinister quiet. When the night was still, it was too still, as though the tree frogs, katydids, and sleepy mockingbirds were too frightened to raise their voices in the usual summer night chorus. Now and again, the quiet was broken sharply by the crack-cracking of musket fire in the last line of defenses. Often in the late night hours, when the lamps were out and Melanie asleep and deathly silence pressed over the town, Scarlet, lying awake, heard the latch of the front gate click and soft, urgent tappings on the front door. Always, faceless soldiers stood on the dark porch, and from the darkness many different voices spoke to her. Sometimes a cultured voice came from the shadows. "Madam, my abject apologies for disturbing you, but could I have water for myself and my horse?" Sometimes it was the hard burring of a mountain voice. Sometimes the odd nasals of the flat wiregrass country to the far south.
occasionally the lulling drawl of the coast that caught at her heart, reminding her of Ellen's voice.
"Missy, I got a partner here who I was aiming to get to the hospital, but looks like he ain't gone to last that far. Can you take him in?" "Lady, I sure could do with some victuals. I sure relish a corn pone if it didn't deprive you none."
"Madam, forgive my intrusion, but could I spend the night on your porch? I saw the roses and smelled the honeysuckle, and it was so much like home that I was emboldened." "No, these nights were not real. They were a nightmare, and the men were part of that nightmare. Men without bodies or faces, only tired voices speaking to her from the warm dark. Draw water, serve food, lay pillows on the front porch, bind wounds, hold the dirty heads of the dying. No, this could not be happening to her. Once, late in July, it was Uncle Henry Hamilton who came tapping in the night. Uncle Henry was minus his umbrella and carpetbag now, and his fat stomach as well. The skin of his pink fat face hung down in loose folds, like the dewlaps of a bulldog, and his long white hair was indescribably dirty. He was almost barefoot, crawling with lice, and he was hungry. But his irascible spirit was unimpaired. Despite his remark, "It's a foolish war when old fools like me are out toting guns," the girls received the impression that Uncle Henry was enjoying himself. He was needed, like the young men, and he was doing a young man's work. Moreover, he could keep up with the young men, which was more than Grandpa Merriweather could do, he told them gleefully. Grandpa's lumbago was troubling him greatly, and the captain wanted to discharge him. But Grandpa wouldn't go home. He said frankly that he preferred the captain's swearing and bullying to his daughter-in-law's coddling and her incessant demands that he give up chewing tobacco and launder his beard every day. Uncle Henry's visit was brief, for he had only a 4-hour furlough, and he needed half of it for the long walk in from the breastworks and back. "Girls, I'm not going to see you all for a while," he announced as he sat in Melanie's bedroom, luxuriously wriggling his blistered feet in a tub of cold water Scarlet had set before him. "Our company is going out in the morning." "Where?" questioned Melanie, frightened, clutching his arm.
"Don't put your hand on me," said Uncle Henry irritably. "I'm crawling with lice. War would be a picnic if it wasn't for lice and dysentery. Where am I going? Well, I haven't been told, but I've got a good idea. We're marching south toward Jonesboro in the morning, unless I'm greatly in error."
"Oh, why toward Jonesboro?"
"Because there's going to be big fighting there, Missy. The Yankees are going to take that railroad if they possibly can, and if they do take it, it's goodbye, Atlanta."
"Oh, Uncle Henry, do you think they will?"
"Shucks, girls, no. How can they when I'm there?"
Uncle Henry grinned at their frightened faces and then, becoming serious again,
"It's going to be a hard fight, girls. We've got to win it. You know, of course, that Yankees have got all the railroads except the one to Macon, but that isn't all they've got. Maybe you girls didn't know it, but they've got every road, too, every wagon lane and bridle path, except the McDonough Road. Atlanta's in a bag, and the strings of the bag are at Jonesboro. And if the Yankees can take the railroad there, they can pull up the strings and have us just like a possum in a poke. So we don't aim to let them get that railroad. I may be gone a while, girls. I just came to tell you all goodbye and to make sure Scarlet was still with you, Melly."
"Of course she's with me," said Melanie fondly. "Don't you worry about us, Uncle Henry, and do take care of yourself." Uncle Henry wiped his wet feet on the rag rug and groaned as he drew on his tattered shoes. "I got to be going," he said. "I've got 5 miles to walk. Scarlet, you fix me up some kind of lunch to take. Anything you've got." After he had kissed Melanie goodbye, he went down to the kitchen where Scarlet was wrapping a corn pone and some apples in a napkin. "Uncle Henry, is it really so serious?"
"Serious? God almighty, yes. Don't be a goose. We're in the last ditch."
"Do you think they'll get to Tara?"
"Why," began Uncle Henry, irritated at the feminine mind which thought only of personal things when broad issues were involved. Then, seeing her frightened, woe-begone face, he softened. "Of course they won't. Tara's 5 miles from the railroad, and it's the railroad the Yankees want. You've got no more sense than a June bug, missy." He broke off abruptly. "I didn't walk all this way here tonight just to tell you all goodbye. I came to bring Millie some bad news, but when I got up to it, I just couldn't tell her. So I'm going to leave it to you to do."
"Ashley isn't... You haven't heard anything that he's dead?"
"Now, how would I be hearing about Ashley when I've been standing in rifle pits up to the seat of my pants in mud?" the old gentleman asked testily. "No. It's about his father. John Wilkes is dead."
Scarlet sat down suddenly, the half-wrapped lunch in her hand.
"I came to tell Melly, but I couldn't. You must do it. And give her these."
He hauled from his pocket a heavy gold watch with dangling seals, a small miniature of the long-dead Mrs. Wilkes, and a pair of massive cuff buttons. At the sight of the watch, which she had seen in John Wilkes' hands 1,000 times, the full realization came over Scarlet that Ashley's father was really dead. And she was too stunned to cry or to speak. Uncle Henry fidgeted, coughed, and didn't look at her, lest he catch sight of a tear that would upset him.
"He was a brave man, Scarlet. Tell Melly that. Tell her to write it to his girls. And a good soldier for all his years. A shell got him. Came right down on him and his horse. Tore the horses. I shot the horse myself, poor creature. A fine little mare she was. You'd better write Mrs. Tarleton about that, too. She set a store on that mare. Wrap up my lunch, child. I must be going. There, dear. Don't take it so hard. What better way can an old man die than doing a young man's work?"
"Oh, he shouldn't have died. He shouldn't have ever gone to the war. He should have lived and seen his grandchild grow up and die peacefully in bed. Oh, why did he go? He didn't believe in secession, and he hated the war, and..."
"Plenty of us think that way, but what of it?"
Uncle Henry blew his nose grumpily.
"Do you think I enjoy letting Yankee riflemen use me for a target at my age? But there's no other choice for a gentleman these days. Kiss me goodbye, child. And don't worry about me. I'll come through this war safely."
Scarlet kissed him, and heard him go down the steps into the dark, heard the latch click on the front gate. She stood for a minute looking at the keepsakes in her hand. And then she went up the stairs to tell Melanie. At the end of July came the unwelcome news, predicted by Uncle Henry, that the Yankees had swung around again toward Jonesboro. They had cut the railroad 4 miles below the town, but they had been beaten off by the Confederate cavalry, and the engineering corps, sweating in the broiling sun, had repaired the line. Scarlet was frantic with anxiety. For 3 days she waited, fear growing in her heart. Then a reassuring letter came from Gerald. The enemy had not reached Terra. They had heard the sound of the fight, but they had seen no Yankees. Gerald's letter was so full of brag and bluster as to how the Yankees had been driven from the railroad that one would have thought he personally had accomplished the feat single-handed. He wrote for 3 pages about the gallantry of the troops, and then, at the end of his letter, mentioned briefly that Corrine was ill. The typhoid, Mrs. O'Hara said it was. She was not very ill, and Scarlet was not to worry about her, but on no condition must she come home now, even if the railroad should become safe. Mrs. O'Hara was very glad now that Scarlet and Wade had not come home when the siege began. Mrs. O'Hara said Scarlet must go to church and say some rosaries for Corrine's recovery. Scarlet's conscience smote her at this last, for it had been months since she had been to church. Once she would have thought this omission a mortal sin, but somehow staying away from church did not seem so sinful now as it formerly had. But she obeyed her mother, and going to her room, gabbled a hasty rosary. When she rose from her knees, she didn't feel as comforted as she had formerly felt after prayer. For some time she had felt that God wasn't watching out for her, the Confederates or the South, in spite of the millions of prayers ascending to him daily. That night she sat on the front porch with Gerald's letter in her bosom, where she could touch it occasionally and bring Tara and Ellen closer to her. The lamp in the parlor window threw odd golden shadows onto the dark vine-shrouded porch, and the matted tangle of yellow-climbing roses and honeysuckle made a wall of mingled fragrance about her. The night was utterly still. Not even the crack of a rifle had sounded since sunset, and the world seemed far away. Scarlet rocked back and forth, lonely, miserable since reading the news from Terra, wishing that someone, anyone, even Mrs. Merriweather, were with her. But Mrs. Merriweather was on night duty at the hospital. Mrs. Meade was home making a feast for Phil, who was in from the front lines, and Melanie was asleep. There was not even the hope of a chance caller. Visitors had fallen off to nothing this last week, for every man who could walk was in the rifle pits or chasing the Yankees about the countryside near Jonesboro. It was not often that she was alone like this, and she didn't like it. When she was alone, she had to think, and these days, thoughts were not so pleasant. Like everyone else, she had fallen into the habit of thinking of the past, the dead. Tonight, when Atlanta was so quiet, she could close her eyes and imagine she was back in the rural stillness of Terra, and that life was unchanged, unchanging. But she knew that life in the county would never be the same again. She thought of the 4 Tarletons, the red-haired twins, and Tom and Boyd, and a passionate sadness caught at her throat. Why, either Stu or Brent might have been her husband. But now, when the war was over and she went back to Terra to live, she would never again hear their wild halloos as they dashed up the avenue of cedars. And Rayford Calvert, who danced so divinely, would never again choose her to be his partner. And the Monroe boys and little Joe Fontaine and... "Oh, Ashley," she sobbed, dropping her head into her hands. "I'll never get used to you being gone." She heard the front gate click, and she hastily raised her head and dashed her hand across her wet eyes. She rose and saw it was Red Butler coming up the walk, carrying his wide Panama hat in his hand. She hadn't seen him since the day when she had alighted from his carriage so precipitously at 5 Points. On that occasion, she had expressed the desire never to lay eyes on him again. But she was so glad now to have someone to talk to, someone to divert her thoughts from Ashley, that she hastily put the memory from her mind. Evidently he had forgotten the contretemps, or pretended to have forgotten it, for he settled himself on the top step at her feet without mention of their late difference.
"So you didn't refugee to Macon? I heard that Miss Pitty had retreated, and of course I thought you had gone too. So when I saw you light, I came here to investigate. Why did you stay?"
"To keep Melanie company. You see, she... well, she can't refugee just now."
"Thunderation!"
he said, and in the lamplight she saw that he was frowning.
"You don't mean to tell me that Mrs. Wilkes is still here? I never heard of such idiocy. It's quite dangerous for her in her condition."
Scarlett was silent, embarrassed, for Melanie's condition was not a subject she could discuss with a man. She was embarrassed, too, that Rhett should know it was dangerous for Melanie. Such knowledge sat ill upon a bachelor.
"It's quite ungallant of you not to think that I might get hurt, too," she said tartly.
His eyes flickered with amusement.
"I'd back you against the Yankees any day."
"I'm not sure that that's a compliment," she said uncertainly.
"It isn't," he answered. "When will you stop looking for compliments in men's latticed utterances?"
"When I'm on my deathbed," she replied and smiled, thinking that there would always be men to compliment her, even if Rhett never did.
"Vanity, vanity," he said. "At least you're frank about it."
He opened his cigar case, extracted a black cigar, and held it to his nose for a moment. A match flared. He leaned back against a post and, clasping his hands about his knees, smoked a while in silence. Scarlett resumed her rocking, and the still darkness of the warm night closed about them. The mockingbird, which nested in the tangle of roses and honeysuckle, roused from slumber and gave one timid, liquid note. Then, as if thinking better of the matter, it was silent again. From the shadow of the porch, Rhett suddenly laughed, a low, soft laugh.
"So you stayed with Mrs. Wilkes. This is the strangest situation I ever encountered."
"I see nothing strange about it," she answered uncomfortably, immediately on the alert.
"No? But then you lack the impersonal viewpoint. My impression has been for some time past that you could hardly endure Mrs. Wilkes. You think her silly and stupid, and her patriotic notions bore you. You seldom pass by the opportunity to slip in some belittling remark about her, so naturally it seems strange to me that you should elect to do the unselfish thing and stay here with her during this shelling. Now, just why did you do it?"
"Because she's Charlie's sister, and a sister to me," answered Scarlett, with as much dignity as possible, though her cheeks were growing hot.
"You mean because she's Ashley Wilkes' widow?"
Scarlett rose quickly, struggling with her anger.
"I was almost on the point of forgiving you for your former boorish conduct, but now I shan't do it. I wouldn't have ever let you come upon this porch at all, if I hadn't been feeling so blue, and—"
"Sit down and smooth your ruffled fur," he said,
and his voice changed. He reached up, and taking her hand, pulled her back into her chair.
"Why are you blue?"
"Oh, I had a letter from Tara today. The Yankees are close to home, and my little sister is ill with typhoid, and so now, even if I could go home like I want to, Mother wouldn't let me for fear I'd catch it, too. Oh, dear. And I do so want to go home."
"Well, don't cry about it," he said, but his voice was kinder. "You are much safer here in Atlanta, even if the Yankees do come, than you'd be at Terra. The Yankees won't hurt you, and typhoid would."
"The Yankees wouldn't hurt me? How can you say such a lie?"
"My dear girl, the Yankees aren't fiends. They haven't horns and hooves, as you seem to think. They're pretty much like Southerners. except with worse manners, of course, and terrible accents.
Why, the Yankees would...
rape you? I think not. Though, of course, they'd want to.
If you are going to talk vilely, I shall go into the house, she cried, grateful that the shadows hid her crimson face.
Be frank. Wasn't that what you were thinking?
Oh, certainly not.
Oh, but it was. No use getting mad at me for reading your thoughts. That's what all our delicately nurtured and pure-minded Southern ladies think. They have it on their minds constantly. I'll wager even dowagers like Mrs. Merriweather.
Scarlet gulped in silence. Remembering that whenever two or more matrons were gathered together in these trying days, they whispered of such happenings, always in Virginia or Tennessee or Louisiana, never very close to home. The Yankees raped women and ran bayonets through children's stomachs and burned houses over the heads of old people. Everyone knew these things were true, even if they didn't shout them on the street corners. And if Rhett had any decency, he would realize they were true and not talk about them. And it wasn't any laughing matter, either. She could hear him chuckling softly. Sometimes he was odious. In fact, most of the time he was odious. It was awful for a man to know what women really thought about and talked about. It made a girl feel positively undressed. And no man ever learned such things from good women, either. She was indignant that he had read her mind. She liked to believe herself a thing of mystery to men. But she knew Rhett thought her as transparent as glass.
"Speaking of such matters," he continued, "have you a protector or a chaperone in the house? The admirable Mrs. Merriweather or Mrs. Mead? They always look at me as if they knew I was here for no good purpose."
"Mrs. Mead usually comes over at night," answered Scarlet, glad to change the subject. "But she couldn't tonight. Phil, her boy, is home."
"What luck," he said softly, "to find you alone."
Something in his voice made her heart beat pleasantly faster, and she felt her face flush. She had heard that note in men's voices often enough to know that it presaged a declaration of love. Oh, what fun! If he would just say he loved her, how she would torment him and get even with him for all the sarcastic remarks he had flung at her these past 3 years. She would lead him in a chase that would make up for even that awful humiliation of the day he witnessed her slapping Ashley. And then she'd tell him sweetly she could only be a sister to him and retire with the full honors of war. She laughed nervously in pleasant anticipation.
"Don't giggle," he said, and taking her hand, he turned it over and pressed his lips into the palm. Something vital, electric, leaped from him to her at the touch of his warm mouth, something that caressed her whole body thrillingly. His lips traveled to her wrist, and she knew he must feel the leap of her pulse as her heart quickened, and she tried to draw back her hand. She hadn't bargained on this treacherous warm tide of feeling that made her want to run her hands through his hair, to feel his lips upon her mouth. She wasn't in love with him, she told herself confusedly. She was in love with Ashley. But how to explain this feeling that made her hands shake and the pit of her stomach grow cold? He laughed softly.
"Don't pull away. I won't hurt you."
"Hurt me? I'm not afraid of you, Rhett Butler, or of any man in shoe leather," she cried, furious that her voice shook as well as her hands.
"An admirable sentiment. But do lower your voice. Mrs. Wilkes might hear you, and pray compose yourself." He sounded as though delighted at her flurry.
"Scarlet, you do like me, don't you?"
That was more like what she was expecting. Well, sometimes, she answered cautiously. When you aren't acting like a varmint.
He laughed again, and held the palm of her hand against his hard cheek.
I think you like me because I am a varmint. You've known so few dyed in the wool varmints in your sheltered life that my very difference holds a quaint charm for you.
This was not the turn she had anticipated, and she tried again without success to pull her hand free.
That's not true. I like nice men. Men you can depend on to always be gentlemanly.
You mean men you can always bully. It's merely a matter of definition. But no matter.
He kissed her palm again.
And again the skin on the back of her neck crawled excitedly. But you do like me.
Could you ever love me, Scarlet?
Ah, she thought, triumphantly. Now I've got him.
And she answered with studied coolness.
Indeed, no. That is, not unless you mended your manners considerably.
And I have no intention of mending them. So you could not love me. That is as I hoped. For while I like you immensely, I do not love you. And it would be tragic indeed for you to suffer twice from unrequited love, wouldn't it, dear? May I call you dear, Mrs. Hamilton? I shall call you dear whether you like it or not, so no matter, but the proprieties must be observed.
You don't love me?
No, indeed. Did you hope that I did?
Don't be so presumptuous.
You hoped. Alas, to blight your hopes. I should love you, for you are charming and talented at many useless accomplishments. But many ladies have charm and accomplishments and are just as useless as you are. No, I don't love you. But I do like you tremendously, for the elasticity of your conscience, for the selfishness which you seldom trouble to hide, and for the shrewd practicality in you which I fear you get from some not too remote Irish peasant ancestor.
Peasant? Why, he was insulting her. She began to splutter wordlessly.
Don't interrupt, he begged, squeezing her hand. I like you because I have those same qualities in me, and like begets liking. I realize you still cherish the memory of the godlike and wooden-headed Mr. Wilkes, who's probably been in his grave these 6 months. But there must be room in your heart for me, too. Scarlet, do stop wriggling. I am making you a declaration. I have wanted you since the first time I laid eyes on you, in the hall at 12 Oaks, when you were bewitching poor Charlie Hamilton. I want you more than I have ever wanted any woman. And I've waited longer for you than I've ever waited for any woman.
She was breathless with surprise at his last words. In spite of all his insults, he did love her. And he was just so contrary he didn't want to come out frankly and put it into words, for fear she'd laugh.
Well, she'd show him, and write quickly. Are you asking me to marry you?
He dropped her hand and laughed so loudly she shrank back in her chair.
Good Lord, no! Didn't I tell you I wasn't a marrying man?
But, what?
He rose to his feet and, hand on heart, made her a burlesque bow.
Dear, he said quietly, I am complimenting your intelligence by asking you to be my mistress without having first seduced you.
Mistress?
Her mind shouted the word, shouted that she had been vilely insulted. But in that first startled moment she did not feel insulted. She only felt a furious surge of indignation that he should think her such a fool. He must think her a fool if he offered her a proposition like that, instead of the proposal of matrimony she had been expecting. Rage, punctured vanity, and disappointment threw her mind into a turmoil, and before she even thought of the high moral grounds on which she should upbraid him,